The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the University of Alberta, the Students' Union, or CJSR.
Good evening, listeners and fellow skeptics. You are now listening to the breath of fresh air known as Skeptically Speaking, the show where we ask you to call in and question everything. We have a busy hour ahead, so let's light a match and get right to it. Skeptically Speaking starts right now, so take it away, Dez.
Thanks, Sean. So, hello, lovelies. Today's show is all about quitting smoking. We have three smokers in the studio tonight. Brownian, regular host of our Brownian Motion segment.
Oh, this is where I say hello?
Hi.
Hi, I'm Brownian.
We have speaking up semi-regular Mike Harrison.
Hello.
And myself. Yes, I'm a smoker. We've all done some research on different ways to quit smoking, and in the interest of science and our health or something, we're going to put a few of them into practice. So if you've quit, failed to quit, have a question about quitting smoking, or just want to provide your moral support, do call in to 780-492-2577 extension 1. You can also email us at live at skepticallyspeaking.com. That's also important. Or if what you have to say is less than 140 characters, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. So let's just give some background here. When did you guys start smoking?
For me, it was about 10 years ago, I guess. 1999 would have been the year. Yeah.
Was it a good year?
Yeah. I mean, I did for that song, and I'm still happy about it.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. All right.
I started... Oh, geez. When I was in grade 8, I think, was the first time I smoked at all. And in fact, I remember the first time I smoked a full cigarette by myself and had two and ended up going to class and getting so sick and passing out on the desk. Unfortunately, we had a sub, and some of the other students, I think, convinced the sub that I was a drug addict. But yeah, the sub actually went up and down the rows and skipped over me because she was scared of the drooling junkie.
Good.
And you're like, I need to keep doing this.
But what was funny, and then I actually didn't until I started working in a restaurant at 17, and that's when I started smoking.
Oh.
So, full time. And I've quit since then a couple of times. And, but obviously...
I love that. I've quit a couple of times.
Well, I have.
I would call that a hiatus.
Sure, okay.
All right.
Took a little break.
I mean, can we really say that anybody... I mean, unless you die at some point in time, we can't really say that anybody who is a former smoker isn't just taking some sort of indefinite hiatus.
I call it sleep. That's when I take my hiatus.
I've seen you smoke. That's pretty well the longest period of time that you tend to go.
Absolutely.
Actually, sometimes.
And, you know, for everyone, I started smoking at around 10. So...
This morning?
No, when I was 10 years old, really.
I thought, you know, so, 10 months...
10 months, you know, if I could have. If I could have walked my way over to that cigarette. The table was high.
Yeah.
Actually, let's everyone talk about why do you smoke now? Because it's different from, you know, when you smoke when you're young and there's peer pressure or there's other social issues or you're just curious. But why do you keep smoking?
This show is so nerve-wracking. There's no way I could make it through if I didn't smoke.
Well, now I have no excuse of my own. No, seriously, guys, why do you quit? Why do you keep smoking?
Well, I mean, in my case, it's for sure an addiction, and I'd say even in I'm probably not the most chemically addicted smoker around, since it seems that, or at least for most of my life, I had to have no problem going a day or two without smoking, but after a while, it's a habit. There's chemical, physiological, and other sort of addictive mechanisms that we'll kind of get into that sort of keep you going. Plus, I mean, I have to admit, although I don't always like it,
it makes
kind of
you
enjoy
look
it.
Cool, right? Because that's why I smoke.
Yeah. Yeah, that is
That was
true.
Mine.
That is true.
Oh, you was not. Did I steal it?
Yeah, you did.
Score. Okay, so why do we all want to quit?
I mean, that's why I started, for sure.
Because it looked cool?
Well, I don't want to quit because it looks cool.
Oh.
And what's interesting is it's increasingly not becoming. It's not looking cool nearly as much as it used to.
Well, now, let's change the definition of cool. Maybe it's not cool in the sense that it's popular, But it's still cool in the sense that it's a damn the man kind of activity. Damn my health.
You know,
damn everyone around me.
What's funny about that is there were some of the various government programs to quit smoking identified that that's a big selling point for cigarettes. And cigarette companies know this. It's kind of funny that there was a marketing campaign, and I actually don't have the details on it, but where they went and to kids and they said, you know, you think you're sticking it to the man, but the man is selling to you based on the fact that knowing that you're going to take this and go, yeah, screw you.
No, I totally agree.
And so they sell. So by actually smoking, you're playing right into their hands.
And actually, that's why I am quitting. I wish I could say it was a health issue, but it's not. I feel kind of like a bit of an idiot. Like, really? I still smoke?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Because I think most of us want to think that we have the willpower to do anything we want. And it's very frustrating to know that's not quite true.
Definitely.
Well, we do, but, you know, this is what the show is about, is we're going to attempt to quit, correct? So, let's just talk about what the studies do say about smoking. Brownian, can you tell us why smoking is so addictive?
Well, there are a number of things. It's really, really complex. But particularly, nicotine seems particularly well adapted to work with the brain. And rewards our pleasure centers. Particularly, it activates our CNS system. There's all kinds of chemicals, and I'm not a chemist by any means. So I do know that there's something called acetylcholine, which we have in our brains, and that's either a good or a bad thing. And nicotine either makes that more or less. But it stimulates a number of receptors. What's interesting is that it stimulates the CNS, the central nervous system, but it doesn't activate the skeletal system, which normally receptors that do that will activate both. But it turns out that nicotine is missing just one amino acid. And if it had that amino acid, if we smoked a cigarette, we'd probably go into seizure.
Interesting.
Which would be very uncomfortable, if not fatal. And so it's actually just a fluke of nature that nicotine happens to be addictive and not immediately fatal. But it's a reinforcing drug, so it causes your brain to produce actually more acetylcholine receptors, particularly the nicotinic one, which cause you to be definitely more cranky and irritable and feel less like yourself when you're withdrawn from it. Then when you do get your fix, you feel much better. Your brain works better than when you're not smoking. It does increase your concentration skills.
See, Mom.
Well, I don't know that it increases them substantially more than if you'd never smoked at all and just weren't going through the effects of a withdrawal.
I do want to quit, everybody. I do.
But because it tricks the brain into stimulating the reward and pleasure centers, then all the physical and other social aspects around smoking then play into it. So for anybody that does smoke, there's all the aspect about pulling out the cigarette, lighting it, and that. And I remember the first time I'd quit smoking for a substantial period of time, and I'd only smoked for, I don't know, a couple of years at this point, but I was in my second year of university. And probably surprising to everybody here, but I really enjoyed talking and spent all my time in the pub. You just be quiet there. But I'd spend all my time in the campus pub smoking cigarettes and arguing about whatever, as people are wont to do, sort of, you know, liberal arts degree. And I remember I'd have this routine, particularly if I was upset, I'd come in and rant about something. So I'd go into Dewey's, this will date me, but I remember when Dewey's was back in Hub Mall. And so I'd run into Dewey's.
For everyone in America, just ignore this part.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, anyways, this is you know, at the University of Alberta campus pub. I keep forgetting we've got international listeners. I'd run into the pub. And I'm so pissed off, blah, 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 blah. And now, of course, nobody else can talk, right? Everybody sitting at the table is like, oh, great, he's upset about something, and everything's got to stop while we wait for him to tell us the story. And then I'd pull out the cigarette with a flourish, pull it out of my pack, and then, somebody give me a light, right? Somebody trepidatiously give me a cigarette, or a lighter, and I'd light my cigarette, take a deep breath, exhale, and then launch into my rant. So for me, it was not only just that, you know, had the chemical addiction and all of those other things, but it was a really important part of what I considered
your identity.
My identity, and one of the most enjoyable things that I did at university, which was arguing with other people about stuff, right, and having them argue back and that. So there was, lots of pointing and waving of the cigarette. And I remember that brought me back one time because I'd met a friend of a friend who knew me from those times, and I'd been a non-smoker for about 8 months, and we were talking about something, and he said, that's really, really interesting. And for some reason, I felt just not myself. And I said, forget this. And I walked down a block, bought a cigarette, a pack of smokes, came back, lit one up, and then said, you think that's interesting? All right, let me go. And it was kind of a wind up and let me go. And then the hands and the cigarettes and the smoking and the frenetic and the nicotine.
Okay, so, he goes. But you mentioned it being controversial before. One of the things that's controversial about smoking in the first place is that we assume that it's bad for the people who aren't smoking, who are just nearby us when we smoke. Secondhand smoking. So I know Mike did some research on that.
And basically the research, unfortunately, as an aside, I used to work for a tobacco company and we used to sort of...
Full disclosure.
We're sort of...
Conflict of interest.
At times, we would sort of be on the fence about how this used to work. But yeah, pretty much every study says the carcinogenic side effects of secondhand smoke are pretty well defined. There's about 40 active chemicals in there that are carcinogens. Or I think it's 50 active chemicals. And yeah, you can absorb those, not surprisingly, whether you're actually doing the smoking or whether you're, you know, taking it firsthand from one end of the cigarette or getting it reblown toward you. Obviously, you're going to get less. It's not as bad as smoking yourself, but it definitely will impact life expectancy and such if you're exposed to it in a closed environment. So,
The reason why I asked you to research this is because I had read that there are some studies that were pointing out that secondhand smoking wasn't as bad for us as initially thought, and maybe some of the studies put out by... anti-smoking groups were maybe a bit of hyperbole.
I'd say that's true, because there were some studies that came out, trying to remember, I think it was around 10 years ago, essentially. They were actually asserting that it was worse than normal smoking, which doesn't seem to be defensible by the science. It's not as bad as smoking for yourself in most circumstances, in most situations. Yeah, if you're trapped in a tiny little box and you're just breathing all of their secondhand smoke and all that, then, you know, it's conceivable you could have a worse side effect through it, but... in general circumstances, no. It's still going to be not as bad as smoking, although it still will be more harmful than not being exposed to it at all.
Well, we're going to talk about some of the ways to quit smoking, since we know it's bad for us. We do, no matter how much we want it to be good for us. So we'll talk about some different methods to quit and their effectiveness right after this commercial break.
Here at Skeptically Speaking, we encourage you to call in and question everything. During tonight's episode, you can call in at 780-492-CJSR, extension 1, to join in on the conversation. Again, that number is 780-492-2577, extension 1. If you're a little bit shy, please email live@skepticallyspeaking.com or send us a short message to Skeptical Radio on Twitter. After the show, feel free to comment on tonight's episode at skepticallyspeaking.com, where we also make this and past episodes available as a podcast. We'd also love to see you join our Skeptically Speaking Facebook group or have you follow Skeptical Radio on Twitter. Of course, if you want to give us feedback the old school way, you can also email us at feedback@skepticallyspeaking.com.
So let's start with the least scientific methods of quitting, because there's just a plethora of ways to quit, people. I would say the least scientific, actually, before we get into that, let's preface this whole conversation in honor of Simon Singh getting sued by the British Chiropractors Association for saying they happily promote bogus treatments. We're going to be talking about the lack of evidence for various methods, not that people are willfully promoting things that they know don't work. Maybe the promoters are tired or trusting or some such. But regardless, deliberate deception is not implied. So don't sue us, please. Let's start with homeopathy. Okay. You see why I prefaced that right there?
Yeah, no, that was nice. That was nice.
Thanks.
Sound very fair and balanced there.
Oh, yeah, no, we're definitely succeeding there. So homeopathy, for anyone that doesn't know, the dictionary definition is the treatment of disease by minute doses of natural substances that in a healthy person would produce symptoms of disease. So in a nutshell, you put a small amount of the substance that is causing you harm, you dilute it and shake it and dilute it and shake it and dilute it and shake it until you have essentially water, and then you take it and it's supposed to, with the like causes like principle, it's supposed to do some vibration magic and fix you. Not surprisingly, there's very little scientific evidence to support this.
But there are homeopathic stop smoking remedies sold, and they're quite pricey for some of them.
Yeah, no, there definitely are, and they definitely are sold. But if I take what the American Cancer Society has to say about the subject, there is little scientific evidence to support the use of homeopathic aids and herbal supplements as stop smoking methods. No dietary supplement has been proven to effectively help people quit smoking. Most of these supplements are combinations of herbal preparations, but not nicotine. They have no proven track record of helping people to stop smoking. So I think that's sort of...
So nothing.
Nothing, really.
We have nothing.
No.
We have vibrating water.
Yeah. It's pretty nifty.
When anybody's trying to quit smoking, it's a good idea to keep yourself hydrated. So
right,
at least
good.
Has the benefit
good.
Of that.
Yes.
Always the optimist.
Nice guy in there.
All right. So maybe let's go to the possibly the most geeky way I've ever heard of quitting smoking. We're actually on the phone with MC Frontalot, the fantastic MC Frontalot, San Francisco nerdcore hip-hop artist extraordinaire.
Howdy.
Hello. Thanks for being on Skeptically Speaking.
My pleasure.
So you're currently camping.
I am. I'm at a camping wedding in Marin.
Oh, that's lovely. Well, thank you so much for taking time out of your camping wedding.
No problem.
So, although your music rules, we don't have you on the show to talk about that. We have you here to talk about a brilliantly nerdy way to quit smoking, GMing your own habit abatement campaign.
That's right.
Can you tell us a bit about it?
Well, I've stopped smoking a number of times over the years, and sometimes it sticks for a good long time, and sometimes it doesn't. But what I've gotten familiar with is the process of, like, ceasing. And I'm quite bored with it. So this time I decided to cease gradually. But just sort of cutting down the number of cigarettes you get to have every day is just excruciating. And so, as most addicts do, I thought I would pass it on to the sort of higher power, which for me is the 20-sided die. So I took the die and decided I would infuse all the power over my smoking into the die, and it's a little bit like a stripped down D&D campaign. I've got my character, which is a Breathor Inflatagon. He's a level 2 lung elf, and then also I've got the DM, the Dungeon Master, and that's me. So I'm playing the character and I'm DMing, which would be sort of a conflict of interest, but that's what quitting smoking is all about. So every time I want a cigarette, that means that the DM is trying to poison the character, poison trap specifically, and so you have to have a saving throw versus poison to see whether you get out of it. And on day one, I decided that my save versus poison was 15, kind of arbitrarily. And so if I could roll a 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, that meant I was saved from the poison attack and I was not allowed to have a cigarette. Anything under that, I was allowed to smoke. And I was letting myself roll once an hour. And each day of the campaign, my wisdom would go up by one. And I would have a easier will save versus poison, which just made it a slightly harder roll if I wanted my cigarette. So at the end of 16 days, I was down to only being able to smoke if I could roll a 1, which is a critical fail, which is about right. Smoking is like critical fail.
So how's it working?
It didn't work out at all.
Oh, okay.
I broke a... I broke up with a girlfriend on, like, the next to last day, and I got all depressed, and then I just started giving myself extra roles. But in anticipation of having to talk to you guys about my failure, I started the campaign at 10, the beginning of last week, and I figured out my flaw in the first one, which was that if I saved versus the cigarette, like, 3 or 4 hours in a row, the amount that I wanted to smoke was just increasing and increasing and increasing. Like, right after not being allowed to smoke, it's, you know, I just wanted to smoke more than I had right before I rolled. Now, I've got a big pocket full of nicotine gum, and every time, and I'm not timing the rolls, I can roll whenever I want, but if I save versus the poison and don't get to have a cigarette, then I have to chew the nicotine gum, which I guess we're going to call a potion.
Right.
And then at least it's, like, different. I no longer, like, right after you chew one of those accursed things, you definitely don't want a cigarette. So that's actually working out better. And it's also, when I grab the die and I'm like, oh, I want to roll, I have to think, well, maybe I'm going to have to chew a nicotine gum. And then that kind of lowers the number of rolls that I do, too, because I have to be ready for the consequences of failure.
I love how complex you have made this.
And for the record, for all of our listeners out there, Desiree has the biggest grin on her face. She just is loving this so much.
I'm so excited. Well, the reason why I'm so excited is because Sunday I'm actually starting to use this method to quit smoking. And I was thinking, yes, absolutely. This is my method. And I will Twitter about it all the time.
Excellent.
So I was thinking that this would actually probably be a good method because it is so geeky, especially for people like us who, you know, well, at least I used to play a lot of D&D. You know, D&D players really want their characters not to die.
That's right.
It's even sometimes to their own real-life detriment. Because we've all been part of, you know, the marathon D&D games where you call in sick to work the next day because you're so tired and
yes,
you're fried on caffeine.
We've all done that.
Okay, well, at least one of us in this room has.
That's two.
And right. I know that MC Frontalot has. You've been there,
sure.
You not?
Not in recent years. The memory is strong.
Thank you.
Now, okay. I do have a question for both of you. Now, D&D, it's usually a group activity, and this is seemingly you're doing it yourself. So now with you two both, you know, employing this method, could you somehow be playing together or even with other people who might want to play and, you know, make it more of a competition or...
You know, you probably could go in that direction.
You could create a campaign. I mean, there's
a
rich material
idea.
Here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because then you help motivate each other.
We can make a massively multiplayer online smoking cessation game.
If you do that, I am so in.
I'll bet you anything. I can find some funding for that, for sure.
Question is, will the players pay $14.95 a month to not smoke? I'm guessing they won't.
Well, it's cheaper than a month of cigarettes.
I'm pretty amazed at how smokers use their money, actually, so let's see that.
Well, perfect. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Have a wonderful rest of the camping weekend.
Yes, thank you very much.
Good luck. Good luck, all of you.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you.
All right. So let's go in this same geeky direction, the geeky direction that I am so fond of.
Because once we start, we can't stop.
No. And I don't think we need to, Sean.
No, definitely not.
So let's move on to other tech ways of quitting smoking.
Okay, well, as I've often said, if it doesn't have an associated iPod application, iPhone application, it probably doesn't exist. So, quitting smoking has apparently about a dozen quit smoking applications on it now. And they're basically combinations of books / calculators. So some of them are kind of interesting. Like, you put in your vital statistics, you put in, you know, roughly how much you smoke per day, how long you've been smoking, and things like that. And it'll feed you encouraging little bits of information, like, I've apparently spent $27,000 on cigarettes since I started, which is really depressing.
But what would you be spending that money on anyways? Hookers? Blow? I mean...
God, I could only imagine. I mean, it's not fair to speculate at this point. But and I've apparently decreased my lifespan by 1 day. And so,
that's,
I mean, there's...
It? 1 day?
Yeah, one year.
Oh.
1 year. 1 year.
Because I was
one
like,
day.
Really? I'll take it.
No. Right. I'd still like the money back, though. Okay. That would be nice. So yeah, there's a bunch of little interesting tech applications on there. There's also Twitter support for those who are into the Twitter sphere. A lot of the studies have focused on how a great deal of the smoking activity is a social thing, right? Like, we go out to smoke because we're going out to smoke with our friends, and we want to talk with our friends, and it's a very particular social environment. So one of the things that Twitter and, you know, electronic applications could do is give you new things to do with that time when you're not, you know, gesticulating and inhaling cancerous fumes. That might be a really good idea, actually. If you can just have something to fill that time when you're feeling kind of anxious and you would normally be smoking, it could be really helpful. And, you know,
the cops will bust you for doing that kind of stuff in public.
That's true.
Just
they will. Yeah.
We're listening again.
We're such good influences.
And I think we have a caller, actually.
Yes, we do. Nathan, are you there?
I am here.
Hello, Nathan.
Hello,
how's it going, Nathan?
Well, I just butted out my last one.
You're quitting smoking with us?
I'm joining the pack. I am a follower. So I am going to be suffering alongside everyone else.
Yay, it's going to be so fun for me around all these new non-smokers.
This will be great. So how are you quitting, Nathan?
Same way I did it last time. Well, not the exact same way. Last time, the way I did it was, it actually happened to be a New Year's Day, and I ran out of smokes and decided, you know what, I've got a week off of work. Why not? Why the hell not? And then locked myself in my basement for a week's worth of World of Warcraft while I twitched through the nicotine withdrawal.
You see how much nerdery helps people? Do not discount this.
Absolutely. But since I've quit Warcraft, which, strangely enough, was almost as bad as smoking. I will be probably geeking out in other fashions.
Do you have a... What's your new method, Nathan, that you're going to be employing?
Probably going to watch a lot of documentaries.
Interesting.
On cancer, by any chance?
That would... Yeah.
Maybe like
investing, you know. You can think about all the money that you will have 10 years from now. You don't spend
billions and billions of pennies.
I suggest not watching any movie made before like 1970 because they're just filled with people smoking. It's very difficult to watch.
Or modern Battlestar Galactica.
Or anything very from France.
Point. Right. Yeah. Good. All right.
Well, thanks for the call, Nathan, and I'm sure we'll be hearing back from you on your progress. And good luck.
Sure enough. And, just a quick reminder, the Society of Edmonton Atheists is hosting a presentation this Thursday. For Lyndon Lamborn, if anyone's interested in learning about Mormonism.
Great.
From Next Mormon.
Okay, do you want to comment with the details on the blog post for the show?
Absolutely.
All right, thanks, Nathan.
Thanks, Nathan.
Bye. Bye.
Come on, Nathan.
So,
Just before we jump back in, I do have an email. Might as well just get it now while we have the flow a little broken here. This is from, I guess we keep the email semi-anonymous. The story goes, I quit about a year ago reading Alan Carr's East Way to Quit Smoking. It will explain how, as a smoker, most of your information is wrong. It explains very clearly how your addiction works and why. For example, it appears to improve concentration, where it actually was the previous cigarette that messed up your concentration in the first place. He says he quit with no struggle and no drugs, and in his opinion, that any remedy that puts more nicotine in your blood is not helping in the end, that's for sure. Thanks for the email.
All right, let's talk about hypnotherapy. Now, this is something that's interesting because there's a lot of conflicting studies, really. Some studies show that it works. Some studies show that it's really no better than a placebo. And the disagreement is mainly due to the fact that it's really difficult to test hypnotherapy. What with hypnosis being mainly talking slowly and thoughtfully and making people calm and open to suggestion. One article, actually, I thought this was a great quote. It says, hypnosis and the placebo effect are so heavily reliant upon the effects of suggestion and belief that it would be hard to imagine how a credible placebo control could ever be devised for a hypnosis study, which is very true. How do you fake hypnosis?
I faked being hypnotized once.
Could you maybe put the person, hypnotize them? So that they have no memory of, you know, they remember kind of blanking out, but you don't actually give them a suggestion?
But that's not what hypnosis is. If you talk about hypnotherapy, because we're not talking about hypnosis.
Oh, right.
This is hypnotherapy. So basically, you're putting somebody into a relaxed, suggestible state, not hypnotized per se.
Okay.
So how would you fake that? Because really, if hypnosis is the calm, gentle, relaxed, there's no way that you can fake that. So, which is why these studies conflict. But in addition to that, there are other studies that say cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT, has a similar success rate. Now, Wikipedia says that the objective of CBT is to typically to identify and monitor thoughts, assumptions, beliefs, and behaviors that are related and accompanied to debilitating negative emotions, and to identify those which are dysfunctional, inaccurate, or simply unhelpful. This is done in an effort to replace or transcend them with more realistic and useful ones. And so what they do is over and over and over tell you that these behaviors are wrong, and in a calm and relaxing environment, quite often using imagery. So I can see why possibly they would have a similar success rate. And actually, we back when this show was called Q Transmissions a long time ago, we did an entire episode on hypnotherapy. So check skepticallyspeaking.com on the past show page and have a listen. I think we have a call.
Yes, we do. Tark, are you on the line?
I am here.
Long time no talk on the show here. We've been missing you.
I know. Actually, I've been reeling because it rocks my whole world that somebody as obviously intelligent and beautiful as Desiree is a smoker. I'm just stunned by that.
Thank you.
I'm also intelligent and beautiful.
Why not just turn that mic down?
I wanted to bring up another, you know, sort of therapy that you might consider. If you remember an old movie from sometime in the 70s called Cold Turkey, it was about an entire town that was challenged to quit smoking. And the running gag through one of the movies was the character, who was actually a reverend played by Dick Van Dyke, was replacing his smoking habit with sexual activity. So there's another suggestion you guys can take and run with.
The distraction technique. Very nice.
Start and stop quitting. All right.
That's actually, would you mind after the show posting that on the blog as soon as we get the post-show links up?
Oh, sure.
Wonderful. Thanks very much for calling.
No problem. I had to wait for Nathan to call first this time, too.
Oh, so.
How kind.
Respectful.
Thank you, Tark.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Actually, I want to disagree with you, Desiree, on the CBT therapy, because CBT is not always reinforcing necessarily that way. And in fact, one of the components about how it works is that you actually get the patient to do the talking.
Mm-hmm.
So not like hypnotherapy at all. And in fact, QuitCore, a program that's being offered by the government of Alberta, that's a non-smoking a smoking cessation program, involves not just quitting smoking cold turkey, but also the use of nicotine replacement therapies, as well as support groups such as group support, which involve a lot of cognitive behavioral therapy. Unfortunately, that program is really new, so we don't have a lot of stats on how successful it is, although it's been built on a program that they've been running in Calgary apparently for about 25 years, and they've been able to help, they claim 6,000 over the course of their program, 6,000 people to quit.
And there are different schools of cognitive behavioral therapy, so not all of them deal with imagery.
Yeah, and that's right.
So if it's not in a calm and relaxing environment, what kind of, do they give you boxing gloves?
Well,
because I think that would be a kind of therapy that I could get behind.
I know a friend who was in cognitive behavioral therapy for quite a long time, actually, for not related to smoking, but depression. Yeah, sometimes there was nothing calm and relaxing about that. Because one of the things that people need to do is deal with emotional issues, and particularly the thought patterns that are revealed when people get particularly emotional. I imagine not having any first-hand experience or knowledge about people who've gone through the QuitCore program itself yet, and how they would talk about that with smoking. But I would imagine, based on my knowledge of other cognitive behavioral groups, that you go, well, when do you smoke? How did you? Essentially, what we did here at the beginning. When did you start smoking? Well, I have a fight with my wife, or I have a fight with my girlfriend or boyfriend, or something like that. And then I really want to smoke. And in fact, that was something that we just heard from DJ Front a lot too, right? So.
Well, you should just continue on with the other state-supplied resources?
Well, other than that's the biggest one, and that's been the new rollout that's come out of the what was formerly the Alberta Cancer Board, which is now Alberta Health Services. But previous to that, Capital Health Program, which is the regional health authority centered around Edmonton and the surrounding region, had a program called Kick the Nick. That was particularly aimed at teens. Most of the smoking cessation programs they had there were small hospital or health authority run ones, but nothing widespread. So now, with the rollout of QuitCore, which is concentrated with a lot of resources for health professionals and doctors to assist them in assisting their patients in quitting. So here's what you can recognize. Here's how to talk to your patients. Here's how to suggest and why you need to suggest to your patients that they should quit smoking. So that's the big one. And like I said, I'll post the link up to QuitCore. It's just started in January. I know that just at the beginning of May, it's a long 12-week program in which, you know, you deal with, if necessary, nicotine replacement therapy. So that being the patch, Champex. Sorry, that's not nicotine replacement, is it? Champex? No, that's...
No.
Or else some of the drugs such as Champex and that, as well as a mix of support groups and group therapy that go through and discussions with individuals that have quit. So I was just on the website today. I don't know when their new rollout or when their new intake is because it is a group program, but I will lead people to that information as soon as
so again, the number is 492-2577, extension 1, or live at skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you tweet at Skeptical Radio. So let's actually talk a bit, you mentioned Champix. Before we get to Champix, actually, let's talk about Zyban, because I have some things to say about Champix.
Yeah, so Champix is, we'll get to that in a second. But the first one on my list here is Zypan, which is also known as Wellbutrin. It's an antidepressant. Basically, it acts as a norepinephrine and dopamine reuptake inhibitor. What that basically means is when these neurotransmitters are released into the synapse, which is the space in between all the neurons, this prevents those neurotransmitters from being sucked back up into the neuron space. And what that basically means is that they end up stimulating the synapses more, and you have more activity associated with these neurotransmitters. As with other antidepressants, it's not really clear what they're doing because there's a lot of implications. You know, many things are activated and there are many different related parts, but we know that it has to do with movement, memory, focus, and pleasure. In studies, we find that about 27% of subjects who received it report that the urge to smoke was a problem. 56 reported it does work because 27% wanted to smoke if they had the drug. 56% wanted to smoke if they just had a placebo. So we know that it works in controlled experiments. The most common problems are insomnia, constipation, dizziness, and dry mouth. And there have been some reports of panic attacks and seizures and things like that, but those are considered quite rare. So
suddenly smoking sounds fun.
Yeah.
Odd how that happens.
Well, one thing you didn't mention about Zyban, though, was, you know, again, audience, this is completely anecdotal evidence, but a lot of the people I've spoken to that have been on Zyban have reported crazy dreams. So
I've heard that too. Yeah.
So, but it hasn't been written anywhere when I was looking at this besides forums. But it's nowhere on the Zyban site.
No, but actually, like, yeah, my cousin who's on it actually reported the same thing. It's one of those weird. I don't know why it hasn't been recorded in the literature yet, but.
Now, at higher rates than other SSRIs?
It's a completely unscientific anecdotal sort
Absolutely.
Of point, but yeah. Which
but it is an interesting fact, though, it's yeah. that I have heard it so often, yeah. but not in any of the, you know, the formal literature.
I wonder if
about
that
this.
Classifies as like an urban legend having to do with like stop smoking medication.
Maybe.
Moving on to Champix. This is by Pfizer. It's an anti-smoking drug, and I can't really pronounce it. I think it's varenicline tartrate. But anyway, it's known as Chantix in the States and Champix in Canada. more than 5 million people have taken the drug to kick the habit. And basically, it affects the way dopamine works and is supposed to block cravings and withdrawal symptoms. It works by blocking nicotine from binding to the receptors in the cell. Again, we're going back to the synapses. And it may reduce the pleasurable effects of smoking. I have heard that is true from people, just that when they're smoking after on Champix, it just doesn't really do the thing that we smokers love. It's not really, not without side effects, though. In 2007, we started getting reports, dozens of reports, of patient deaths and suicidal thoughts of behavior among Chantix users. In 2009, Health Canada reminded people taking Champix about the possible side effects of agitation, depressed mood, hostility, changes in behavior, impulsive or disturbing thoughts, and thoughts of harming themselves or others.
This is the part we're talking about. Suicidal ideation and vaguely homicidal behavior. This is what I find interesting.
But again, a number of those side effects are not in common with any other antidepressant particularly. I'm just wondering if the rates in those are particularly higher.
I don't really have comparative literature on that right now. But, like, for example, 2008, there were 818 reports of adverse reactions associated with the medication. 520 of those reports were linked to psychiatric problems, so that raises a legitimate point. It's no doubt, everything in the brain is a complicated interweb of things. So it may be related to something else. It's just not strictly Champix that's doing it, but it's still nevertheless a present effect. It is severe enough that in May 2008, the Federal Motor Vehicle Carrier Safety Association ruled that taking Chantix, which is the state equivalent again, could make interstate truck and bus drivers unfit for work. There was another thing having to do with air traffic controllers. An estimated Federal Aviation Administration has banned all of its pilots and air traffic controllers from taking Chantix. An estimated 150 pilots and 30 air traffic controllers were either taking the drug or taken in the past. And anyway, they can't now.
So wow.
Which is quite a few.
So bring a pack of smokes next time you go on the plane. Make sure, just in case, the pilot's wigging out.
And I would, I had my own personal anecdotal experience with Champix, and it definitely made me not want to smoke. I had no urge to smoke at all. It was brilliant. What I did want to do, however, is kill people. I had no suicidal ideation, but I tell you, I have never, and anybody who knows me knows that I'm vaguely angry.
Yeah, the fact that it made you want to kill people more.
So sorry, what happened when you were on the Champix?
All I'm saying is that on day four of not smoking, and when you're taking the full dosage of the medication, because you do ramp it up, you start with the lower dosage and you increase it. By day four of the full dosage, I actually, at work, had to go into my office and breathe deeply because I felt such a feeling of rage, and it felt very artificial. But such a feeling of rage that I actually had to go into my office and take a few days off work after that. And but I'm still smoking, so I obviously went off that. That was fun.
But such is life.
Absolutely. But did you know that there are ways that you can quit smoking, but not have to leave your nicotine? There are.
I'm skeptical.
We'll tell you more about it right after the break. On the next Skeptically Speaking, we'll be talking about geology with Dr. Hans Mikkel. How do we know how old rocks or fossils are? Or the Earth, for that matter? How do we know it's not hollow? Is it possible to prove or disprove Noah's flood? How about the Loch Ness Monster? Can rocks, sometimes known as crystals, heal you? We'll ask all these questions and more on the next Skeptically Speaking, every Friday at 6 p.m. here on CJSR. Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. We have Catherine Neeson with us. She's a research associate for the Tobacco Harm Reduction, THR, group on the University of Alberta campus.
Great.
Thanks for being here.
Thanks, no problem.
So tell us about your group, first of all.
Okay. Well, our group is headed up by Dr. Carl Phillips with the School of Public Health at U of A, and I'm a research associate working for him. So we do a lot of research into tobacco harm reduction. And if you want, I can give my little blurb on it.
Absolutely.
Okay. In case people aren't familiar with the term, I'll give a brief explanation of what harm reduction is in general. So in a nutshell, it's simply what the name implies, which is reducing the harm associated with behavior. It's generally used in the context of drug use or sex work. In the case of THR, we're of course talking about drug use, nicotine being the drug of choice. For other drugs, people may be familiar with ideas like safe injection facilities like Insight in Vancouver, methadone maintenance programs for heroin users, free condoms for sex workers, rave-safe programs, and many more examples. Having said that, THR specifically is replacing smoking tobacco with other safer modes of nicotine delivery. It may come as a surprise to some, but nicotine and tobacco are not the really unhealthy components of a cigarette. In fact, nicotine in a normal dose is a mild stimulant, and it's actually very similar to caffeine. The most harmful aspect of smoking is the smoke itself. Regardless of what is being burned, any product of combustion has mostly the same major constituents in it, including carcinogens that are obviously not healthy to inhale. So what tobacco harm reduction is all about is eliminating that smoke and making smokers aware of safer ways to get nicotine. So smokeless tobacco in the form of moist snuff, lozenges, electronic cigarettes, and even pharmaceutical nicotine like the patch or the nicotine inhaler would all qualify as examples of safer ways of delivering or of getting nicotine. These examples differ a bit from one another, so I'll just talk a bit about each one. Firstly, with regard to smokeless tobacco, there's a lot of evidence showing that modern smokeless products present about 1/100th the risk that smoking tobacco does. So said another way, these products are about 99% less harmful than smoking. Most people are very surprised to hear that figure because, unfortunately, there is a bit of a disconnect between the studies that have been done on smokeless tobacco and what is actually presented in anti-smoking and health promotion websites and literature. Many times it's implied that smokeless tobacco is just as dangerous as smoking tobacco, which simply is not the case. Another concern that people have is that smokeless tobacco causes oral cancer, but again, studies have shown that modern smokeless products do not cause a measurable increase in oral or other cancers. So if you look at the relative risks for diseases presented in studies on smokeless tobacco, they're generally very close to one. So in other words, there is no clear association. A good example of a very low-risk smokeless tobacco product is snus, which is moist snuff, packaged in small teabag-like pouches, and it's designed to fit under your upper lip. It's spitless, it's unobtrusive, and it's simply removed when the user feels satisfied. This is something that's very popular in Sweden, and so for anyone interested in doing more research into smokeless tobacco and its risks, I would suggest that studies done in Sweden are a great place to start. A large proportion of people there have successfully made the switch from smoking to snus, and Sweden is now experiencing the lowest smoking-related disease rates in Europe.
Interesting.
So, of course, smokeless tobacco, not always appealing to all smokers. It doesn't give the immediate satisfying jolt of nicotine. It's more of a slow release, and it doesn't have that hand-to-mouth motion that a lot of smokers are very accustomed to. For this reason, electronic cigarettes, or e-cigs, have become quite popular in recent years, and many smokers, including my boyfriend, have successfully switched to these because they imitate smoking behavior quite well. They're a newer invention, so they don't have the evidence base behind them that smokeless tobacco does, but we have every reason to believe that they are probably quite similar in risk because they too provide nicotine in a smokeless form. E-cigs, in case anyone's unfamiliar with them, it's just a battery that lights up when you inhale. It contains a vaporizer, which is activated by the battery upon inhalation, and a nicotine cartridge. So they look and feel like cigarettes. They produce a vapor that looks like smoke when you exhale as well. The concerns raised against e-cigs are that nicotine is dissolved in propylene glycol, which is widely used in many different things, but it hasn't been studied for the long-term effects of inhalation. Of course, it would be difficult to imagine that it could be anywhere near as harmful as inhaling cigarette smoke. And lastly, pharmaceutical nicotine would also qualify as being a safer mode of delivery of nicotine. However, unfortunately, none of these products are designed for long-term use. They don't contain high enough levels of nicotine to satisfy most smokers, nor are they particularly cheap. Having said all this, though, CHR isn't for everyone. There are a lot of people who feel they don't want to use nicotine and would like to quit it entirely, which is understandable, especially in light of all the negative social and political climate surrounding nicotine use. As well, all the smokeless products that I've mentioned today are not 100% risk-free. So these are mostly ideas for people who don't want to or can't quit smoking. Even for those who are having trouble quitting smoking, substitution could be a good idea, since it may take a while for people to quit entirely. And just one last note about harm reduction in general is that, obviously, it's not without its controversies. It is a non-judgmental approach to risky behavior and drug use, in that it tends not to make ethical statements about whether or not a person should be engaging in the behavior. In the context of drug use, harm reduction has had an uphill battle gaining public support because of this characteristic. Despite its growing base of evidence that it does reduce disease, people are reluctant to morally get on board with the idea of things like safe injection sites, safer forms of tobacco and nicotine in this case.
But I find this interesting because some of the people that would actually promote safe injection sites would say that this isn't the way to go. So I'm wondering what the difference is between you know, intravenous drug use and nicotine.
They do, and it's kind of interesting that a lot of tobacco harm reductions are almost like the pariahs of harm reduction.
Absolutely.
It is starting to become a little bit more popular. I believe it's the Royal College of Physicians has finally started to say, well, yes, this might actually be something that we maybe should be telling smokers about because, you know, maybe it should be up to smokers if whether or not they want to use these things. It's interesting because I recently attended a conference on harm reduction in Thailand, and the users there of heroin and people who were using safe injection sites, some of them would actually say that alcohol and tobacco, you couldn't have harm reduction for them, which is interesting, and I think it is sort of a because of the difference between the two.
Absolutely.
Heroin, obviously, if you're addicted to heroin, this is something that's going to have an immediate impact on your life. It affects judgment in a big way. Nicotine, a little different in that respect. Obviously, people can still lead very high-quality lives.
So you're a functional addict, and therefore you don't deserve harm reduction. Interesting.
It's interesting. It might also have a bit to do with the fact that it's legal. It's very hard to compare the two. So,
well, thank you so much for being here, Catherine.
Yeah, no problem.
Very much.
Thank you.
So the, you know, if you, we have one more way of quitting smoking, and, you know, if you have bigger, wait, we got in trouble for swearing last week. If you have bigger nerves than I do, you can go cold turkey.
Yeah, the thing with cold turkey is that, for a lot of reasons, and I'm glad that you brought up, Catherine, you know, whether or not it might be a good intermediate step for people looking to get off of nicotine and saying, okay, well, this might be something to try at the very least, particularly e-cigarettes, is that cold turkey generally has a fairly low success rate. I believe the rates for cold turkey are down to 25% of people who quit cold turkey go back to cigarettes within 48 hours, and up to 60% of them return to smoking within 2 weeks. And that over the course of a year, only, I believe it's only 2.5% of people end up being smoke-free after 1 year with only cold turkey.
Really? That low?
So that's why. Now, keep in mind, though, that is just cold turkey. I mean, there are a number of things that one can do, you know, to increase their rates. And we've already talked to some of them as well. Nicotine replacement therapy, counseling support services and those sorts of things, or some of the medications we were talking about, like Trampex and that. So, I mean, essentially, these are all cold turkey techniques. We're just adding in some other things to reduce the recurrence of the cravings and the irritability and the depression and some of the other factors that cause people to want to go back to cigarettes.
And now there's quite a bit of proof that saying that the more smoking cessation methods you use at one time, the greater likelihood there is that you'll stay quit.
I would imagine that's, I mean, that would for sure be the case. I mean, sorry, I was a little confused because I had this brief moment of somebody, you know, got three patches on, they're chewing the gum, they're talking to their therapist, they're chewing cha. But absolutely. And like I said, going back to the government ones that I was talking about, particularly QuitCore, they do use multiple mm-hmm. approaches to keep people off tobacco for long term. So definitely that, and that's why these sort of multi-pronged techniques tend to be more successful than cold turkey itself.
So you've heard a lot today about different ways you can quit smoking. And, you know, let's just be clear. I wanted to do this show solely so I could walk around with a 20-sided die and a character sheet for a while. Because it's the least sciencey and most geeky way to do it.
Everyone needs a life ambition.
Thank you. I have low standards. So what are you guys going to do? How are you guys going to quit?
Exercise seems to work pretty well. I think you agree with this. I was also thinking about those fancy e-cigarettes, but apparently we're having trouble getting them here in Canada. They're having problems with shipping them in here because they haven't been tested enough, and they're prohibitively expensive in the first place, and there's a lot of debate about the whole glycol thing. So,
yeah, that was a recent thing by Health Canada, and a very unfortunate thing, in my opinion. In the States, they're still available. They are available online. And, of course, the e-cigarettes companies are coming together and trying to provide the evidence that's required. So,
great. Okay. And, Anthony, really quickly here, what's your method?
Cold turkey plus the patch, or nicotine gum is what I'm going to try at first. And we'll see how that goes.
And we all know Dez's method here, the 20-sided die.
So that's all the time we have today. We'll post the ridiculous amount of articles and links we all looked at on the blog. And speaking of the blog, we're going to be writing about our journey to non-smokerdom, otherwise known as anecdotal evidence. So do check in with us at skepticallyspeaking.com to see our progress. So see you next time, possibly as non-smokers. On Skeptically Speaking.
Sounds good. And I just wanted to quickly let everyone know a little update on Bill 44. We've mentioned it over the last few days. That is the legislation talking about pulling kids out of classes. On Tuesday between 10 to 2 o'clock sometime, we are going to be involved with a press conference happening at the legislature grounds in Edmonton here. We'll post more details about that on the blog as well. Thanks for listening, everyone. Have a great night.
Bye, guys.